I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The 01 San Jose Festival aims to transform that city into the North American epicenter for the intersection of art and digital culture by showcasing the world's most innovative contemporary artists. We'll talk to festival directors Steve Dietz and Kim Wallish with the City of San Jose about their ambitious plans for their Festival of Art on the Edge and the effect they expect the festival will have on the city. And we'll talk to Rena Janna, who writes for Business Week, about the magazine's new focus on design and innovation, and about her new book, New Media Art. We'll find out more about 01 San Jose and the new media art it will feature today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Steve Dietz is director of 01 Art and Technology Network, as well as the 01 San Jose Festival. Steve founded internationally acclaimed new media programs at the Smithsonian American Art Museum and the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and he has organized and curated more than a dozen new media exhibitions. Kim Wallish is the City of San Jose's Assistant Director of Economic and Cultural Development. Prior to joining the city, Kim was co-founder and director of Collaborative Economics. She has advised leaders in more than 20 communities, including Chicago, San Diego, Columbus, Fresno, Tianjin, and South Australia. For almost a decade, Kim authored the annual Index of Silicon Valley and helped develop Silicon Valley 2010, a regional framework for growing together. Steve, tell me about 01 San Jose.
01 San Jose is a new biennial digital arts festival being held in August in San Jose. It will happen every 2 years, and in this year we'll be bringing over 200 artists from around 40 countries from all over the world. These artists are working at the intersection of creativity and technology, and in particular this year one of the themes is the idea of the interactive city. So lots of projects that are outdoors, large-scale, performative, urban kinds of projects.
Oh, it sounds exciting. Give me an example, Steve, of the kind of project you're talking about, working at the intersection of creativity and technology that exemplifies the interactive city.
Maybe I can give you two different examples, because I think one of the important things about the festival is to understand digital arts is a very broad field with lots of different kinds of practices. So one example is the idea of how can people have an effect on their environment. And there's a project called P2P, otherwise known as Power to the People. And it's basically an interactive billboard that's comprised of 200 light bulbs. Across the street from this grid of 200 light bulbs are 200 switches. And people can literally turn on and off each light bulb as they're looking at this large-scale billboard on the top of the San Jose Silicon Valley Chamber of Commerce and create their own messaging system or their own messages. And so in that sense, in a small way, they're able to have a kind of electronic speaker's corner and put their own messages into the environment of the city. Another kind of example is a project called Pigeon Blog by the artist Beatrice DaCosta. And this is an example of artists who are working with technology in ways that are unexpected. And what Beatrice is doing is working with pigeon racers from the San Jose area and outfitting pigeons with small backpacks. And in those backpacks is a small computer chip that she's engineered, which contains an air pollution control sensor device, a cell phone, and a GPS tracker. So as they're released from a location in the festival and flying 30 to 90 miles home, they're taking readings of the air pollution levels in the atmosphere, marking where they are through the GPS device, and then automatically phoning in to a central system what the pollution level is, creating a dynamic interactive map of the pollution levels as they're flying home. In other words, blogging the pollution levels as they fly, or pigeon blog. And it's a kind of, in some sense, misuse of technology that lots of artists from Nam June Paik on have done when they're looking at technology. What can I do with it that isn't necessarily about improving it per se?
And how does the viewer or the festival goer experience the Pigeon blog?
Well, there's of course the actual release, which is a sort of, you know, a dramatic kind of gesture. But then because they're sending in this data, there's a large data visualization along with some video tracking of the pigeons. So you basically see a kind of interactive map that might look something like a Doppler radar. You know, here comes the thunderstorm or something like that. So it's basically a large-scale visualization.
Ah. Kim, what statement do you expect 01 San Jose to make for the city of San Jose?
We want 01 San Jose to announce that San Jose Silicon Valley is the leading center for art and technology in North America. Given Silicon Valley's technology base and our digital culture that loves to try new things, we really believe that San Jose can become the center in North America for creative experiences at the intersection of art and technology. So the festival is part of a broader strategy for us.
Is it an aspirational strategy or is it a realized strategy at this point?
To a certain extent, it reflects the reality that Silicon Valley and the Bay Area has had a lot of experimentation going on in the last 10 years in art and technology. But it's aspirational in the sense that we want recognition for this. We want the world to come here, and we want to showcase and spotlight our artists. Other key components of this strategy include a new public art master plan for the airport, which is the only public art master plan in the world that emphasizes all new media art. We're also expanding our San Jose Museum of Art, sort of taking it from mid-city size to big city size, with an emphasis on art and technology exhibitions and education. And then last, we're really focused on partnering with our major urban university, San Jose State University, which turns out is the fifth largest public comprehensive university. It's right in the center of our downtown, and it has the second oldest new media program in the United States. It was founded in the mid-1980s, right after the program at MIT.
That's exciting. What was the genesis of the idea for the festival? Where did this come from?
I think the original genesis actually dates back about 10 years ago when San Jose and the Silicon Valley region developed a cultural strategy. There was a notion at that time that it was time to celebrate Silicon Valley-style creativity, meaning not just creativity in technology and business, but creativity in art and culture and community. So there has been a lot of informal conversations about this probably over a decade. But the real impetus came about 3 years ago, where the city of San Jose adopted an economic development strategy. And in the process of creating that strategy, we heard really for the first time from our business community here that it was time to raise San Jose's cultural profile, that was an important step toward continuing to attract and retain the A students from all over the world. And so a core group of our civic and cultural institutions came together, and an opportunity came to bid on an international conference called the International Symposium of Electronic Arts. This is a very important professional network that meets somewhere in the world every 2 years. So we came together and put together the winning bid to bring ISEA, the International Symposium of Electronic Arts, to San Jose. So that's going to bring 2,000 or 3,000 of the world's leading experts in this field to our community. And so around that symposium, we're building this 7-day 01 public celebration, which we hope will attract upwards of 50,000 people.
And Steve, who do you expect those 50,000 people to be? What kinds of people will be there?
Well, the 50,000 people we're hoping will be basically a broad cross-section of the Bay Area national community. So clearly there will be people who work in the digital arts, in the fields of design, in the fields of urban studies, in architecture. They'll be attending the symposium or looking at these projects sort of purposely. But also we're expecting lots of people who are engineers, who are just general public, who are families. There's a large youth program We're bringing in people from different high schools around the Pacific Rim to participate in a youth ambassador program. One of the themes of the festival, besides Interactive City, is called Community Domain, and that's specifically looking at artists who are using technology, either new technology or technology in new ways, to encourage the general public to create their own ways of telling their stories or of mapping their communities that aren't necessarily artists per se or technologists per se. So again, it's really looking to outreach to a very general public who will, especially because of the Interactive City theme, be essentially stumbling across these projects in the middle of the city and wonder, what is that ice cream truck that's playing karaoke songs about ice cream?
Could you do this festival on the East Coast?
Well, I think that for me, that's one of the really interesting things, having come in from the outside and having worked in many different cities, is that I really can't imagine the kind of cooperation that's happening between the institutions that Kim mentioned, between the city, between the Museum of Art, the Tech Museum, between about 40 different organizations who are really collaborating to make this happen. And I think that scale of cooperation across disciplines, across audiences, would be highly unusual in any city in the United States, whether it's Minneapolis or New York or Boston. There are, of course, important efforts to create similar programs in other cities, but I think they really don't have the scale and the breadth of cooperation that 01 San Jose has managed to pull together, precisely because of the 10 years of planning and of strategic planning to make this happen.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Steve Dietz, he's Festival Director for 01 San Jose, and Kim Wallace, Assistant Director of the Office of Economic Development in San Jose. Steve, it's interesting to me your response to my question, and it you've boiled it down to what's different or what's distinctive here is the level of cooperation among this broad range of institutions. Kim, I know you two have worked around the country in economic development, and I was talking last week with a Silicon Valley-based consultant, and she was describing what she believes is a Silicon Valley Hollywood way of doing things, of optioning and placing bets and then watching their development. Do you believe there's a fundamentally different way of making investments and doing things there than in other parts of the country?
I think we have, to a certain extent, pioneered this model of working across disciplines and getting very good at that over time. I think that's why Silicon Valley companies and industries have been successful. And I think that's partially why our community is very well positioned at this point. We are left brain, right brain people, and we're good at working at teams. I think we also like to come together around big visions and just bring the people and the institutions to the table who need to be to the table for that particular project, and then just make it happen. And then the whole system reconfigures and moves on to the next project and the vision. And I think that is the model that we have for 01, is we have the right people, the right vision, and the right time, and we're in the right place to do it.
Let me ask you both, do you think 01 San Jose represents a fundamentally different way for a city to invest in its arts and culture?
I think that cities around the world are wrestling with this question of what is the real link between cultural development and economic development. And I think this is one model, is to pick a strategic theme that seems right for who you are and what you can become as a city, and organize a number of significant activities and projects around that. As a matter of fact, the first 2 days of the 01 Festival Week, the city of San Jose and a regional network here called First Act Silicon Valley, which stands for Art, Creativity, and Technology, we're actually hosting a global leadership forum on economic and cultural development. We've invited public-private teams from 15 world cities who are also wrestling with this question of how to integrate economic and cultural development to come to San Jose and talk about their experiences. And we have teams coming from Shanghai, Yokohama, Seoul, Helsinki, Liverpool, Linz, Austria, which has been a real model for us. And we're going to showcase model projects. Some of those focus on physical development, new kinds of creative urban centers. Others focus on new media initiatives that are in a similar space to what San Jose is working on. And others are more general kinds of strategies to focus on creative industries. But the root challenge is all the same, in that in a world where competitiveness really depends on talent, there seems like there has to be a strong link between cultural amenities and economic competitiveness.
You said that Linz has been a particular model for you. How so?
Linz, Austria, 26 years ago, started a festival called Ars Electronica, Electronic Arts. And at the time, Linz was a sort of powerhouse economic center, but not necessarily as well known culturally as, say, Vienna and Salzburg. And so at that time, the city basically decided to focus on this area of digital arts as a way to both differentiate themselves, but also to emphasize the creative aspect of the technology programs that were going on in Linz. And since that time, it's really become a world leader in a major annual festival in the digital arts. And Linz's profile, as a result, has really increased significantly in the cultural sphere as well as the economic sphere. So in that sense, both as a highly successful festival that's looking at a range of practices and a city event where for the opening night concert on the Danube alone, 100,000 people attend that open-air concert. So again, it's an example of the expert practitioners from around the world coming to Linz every year, but also a very broad base of public support that has benefited both the field of art and the city itself.
Do you think the art you're showcasing in this festival, is it beginning to make obsolete more traditional art forms? Kim, how do you look at it I'm curious, how do you approach it from an investment strategy or an economic development strategy? You say that 01 San Jose, in part, is a result of an economic development strategy. Where do the more traditional arts fit into that, or do they?
Well, we've made a conscious effort to reach out to traditional arts organizations here, and I would say a substantial number of them have connected to the 01 vision and will be participating in the festival. An example would be we have one of a handful of museums of quilts and textiles in the United States. You might not think on the face of it that they would have anything to do with art and technology, but they're going to be hosting several exhibits and be part of our gallery tour for 01. I do think that cultural institutions are challenged by changing demographics and changing lifestyles. We're one of the three or four most culturally diverse cities in the U.S. right now, and have a lot of people that have moved here from other places and have very different backgrounds. And one point about the technology-based art is that it's very broadly defined. And it's very interactive and it's very participatory. So there's certain parts of the cultural audience that this is a highly engaged form of art. It's not as passive as some traditional art forms. And people will literally be participating with their cell phones and with their laptops and with their physical beings running around the city participating in some of these artworks. And that's exciting because that's true engagement in the arts, quite literally.
It is exciting, and yet we've all seen people run through museums and punch buttons and pull levers and that was the experience. I mean, the experience was punching buttons, not necessarily waiting to see what happens. Steve, I'm curious, the project you described early in our conversation, which I think sounds great, the messaging on the billboards, which people control, can be really exciting, and I can see that people would wait for the outcome because, again, the outcome is the message. How do you encourage people, or do you, to experience the art and not simply the act of participation. Is that a fair question?
No, actually, I think it's a really critical point that you're making. And one of the things that I've emphasized and spent a lot of sort of cycles whenever I speak about the festival as the director is that this really is an art festival. And these projects and these works should do to you what good art does to you. It moves you. It makes you think. It engages you. And so while there is an intersection with technology, we have projects like the Paper Cup Telephone Network that are really not about the latest technology. It's not about the newest thing. It's about how artists can put this together to create experiences. And I think one of the best examples of this that is really a classic of the 21st century is a project that the San Jose Museum of Art will be showing called Listening Post by Mark Hansen and Ben Rubin. And this is basically a grid of 200 video monitors that are displaying real-time data mining of internet chat rooms and displaying what people are typing at that time according to a kind of format that the artists have put over it that really has to do with issues of identity and what it means to understand a global communications system, or at least try to understand something that seems so overwhelming in this project called Listening Post, where you're really spending 20 minutes feeling like you're listening in on the internet. And it's that kind of experience that artists can bring to bear in a way that's a lot different than the latest update on being able to get email on your cell phone or something like that. It's the experience that gets put together. And I think it's a really critical issue that you've pointed to, that it's not just about point and click. It's about what is the experience? What does it make me think? What does it make me question?
And as art is used to do that in the city, out in the public realm, it certainly seems like there's an opportunity to have that happen not simply during a festival, but over time, and change the way people experience the city. I mean, we all know city life, I think, has so many rewards, but it also has its downsides. Do you imagine, Kim, the city of San Jose using the experience that you gain during the festival to take that and use that to animate the city 365 days a year?
Yeah, absolutely. We're having many conversations about this. Our master plan for public art at the airport will turn that airport into a unique kind of experience 365 days a year when you land at San Jose International. We're also looking at incorporating more destination quality public artworks into our downtown that are in this art and technology field. And as a matter of fact, at the 01 Festival, we're going to be premiering a new example of this, which is an artwork by Ben Rubin, which will be along the top of one of Adobe's headquarters towers right in our downtown. It's a really interesting piece called Semaphore. It's beautiful, and it's also a game for those people who are interested in playing the game to figure out what its significance is. Also, digital visual literacy and digital arts is becoming an important component of education. And working with Adobe systems in our school system, we're looking at incorporating digital arts curricula throughout the year in our schools. So there'll be a variety of ways that people can experience digital and new media art between the every 2 year 01 Festival.
That's so exciting. Steve, give me the dates again.
It's August 7th, Monday, August 7th through Sunday, August 13th.
And where can our listeners learn more about the 01 San Jose Festival?
There's probably more than they may ever want to know at our website, 01sj.org. And that includes the list of events, the over 150 art projects, the different collaborators, et cetera.
Great. We'll put that link on our site too, smartcityradio.com. Steve, Kim, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
01 San Jose will be held August 7th through 13th. You can find out more about the festival at smartcityradio.com. We're going to continue our conversation about new media art and its impact on cities when we return with Rena Janna, who covers innovation and design for Business Week. She's the co-author of the book, New Media Art. And we'll talk to Otis White, as we do every week, about the latest news on cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, you've made an interesting discovery. You found that some neighborhoods attract an unusual number of entrepreneurs.
Yeah, it's a little bit unexpected because these folks typically don't have a lot in common. I mean, we're talking here about the self-employed, folks who are solo lawyers, for instance, or maybe solo PR folks. They could be artists, they could be web designers, they could be independent sales reps who, for one reason or other, don't want to work for one boss but want to work for several. Now, typically, these folks are as different as any other set of individuals, but as it turns out, there is at least one neighborhood in the United States, maybe more than one, where these folks kind of congregate. And the real question is sort of what attracts them to this neighborhood. It's in Baltimore. The neighborhood is officially called Keswick, but everybody in the neighborhood calls it Alonzoville, after the bar and grill that's sort of the center point of the neighborhood. Typically in Keswick or Alonzoville, about a third of the households there have self-employed individuals in it. That's about twice the national rate.
Wow.
So they're there for a reason, and so the question is what attracts them to be near one another, and what attracts them in particular this neighborhood? And the answer seems to be that there are larger, older houses that these folks have come in and restored. And because they're older, they have room for a home office, which is a necessity for some of these folks. It also has offices nearby, so if they sort of outgrow their home office, they can move down to another part of the neighborhood and be in a small office space there. There's coffee shops and restaurants around, so they can see each other, because as you probably would know, being self-employed is sometimes a lonely business, so they actually like to be out around other folks, and so they've got these places in walking distance they can go to. And finally, and this is most interesting, they get to know one another, and that becomes a form of business networking and referrals, so that if you're a lawyer and you have a client who needs some web design work, you know someone in your neighborhood that you run into at Alonzo's Bar and Grill or at a coffee shop who does web design, and so on and so forth. Public relations and other types of referrals can be made. So for all of those reasons, these self-employed people have found this one neighborhood in Baltimore to be incredibly hospitable to the way they work.
I would think that with the rise of self-employment in this country, that a lot of cities would be studying Alonzoville and what makes it so successful.
I would think so, and I would think some neighborhoods would probably want to tune into this and build some more of Alonzo's Bars and Grills so that they can attract these folks.
Those are the most special places, aren't they? That great place that defines the neighborhood where everyone gathers. They're just the best places in the world.
More of life has been understood sitting on a stool than perhaps any other place in America.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Rena Janna is a writer for Business Week, where she covers innovation and design. She is co-author with Mark Tribe of the new book, New Media Art. Rena, you've watched people walking the streets of Manhattan with cell phones to their ear, PDAs in their hands,
yes.
Lost in another world that has really very little to do with the physical world that they are currently inhabiting. You may have been one of those people.
Oh, yes.
I know
often.
I have been.
Yeah.
So how is our use of technology, do you think, affecting the way we experience and perceive cities?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think with all of these personal electronics, from cell phones to iPods to PDAs, you know, we look at them sometimes as sort of isolating factors in our lives. But
I think one way we could look at it, too, is that we're building sort of a new community. And, you know, on one hand, while people are sort of in their own space within this shared space of the physical city, they're also sort of creating this new, you know, global network on their own. And then simultaneously sort of having their own individual experience of, say, a New York, a Paris, or a London that's very much their own, that's very personal. So it's kind of a fascinating time where all of these different experiences of cities are happening simultaneously that, you know, whether or not they're good or bad for cities, you know, sometimes it's annoying when someone bumps into you because he or she is engaged so heavily in a personal conversation and doesn't seem to know they're on the street of Manhattan. But at the same time, you know, they're able to navigate two or three different spaces at once. I think it's kind of early to see, you know, how this might affect the experience of cities, but it's kind of fascinating to see, you know, maybe one, two, three different spaces being juggled at one time.
Do you think, is this a new phenomenon?
You know, I think it's one that's sort of been in the making for a while. You know, of course, people were able to sort of be in one shared city at one time, you know, sort of the physical space. Now they're able to be in the physical space and their own sort of personal space within the city, and then also engaging in, you know, maybe even a conference call while they're walking down the street on the cell phone with someone in Shanghai and someone in London all simultaneously. So it's coming out of other routes that have always been there in terms of reaching out and having these global networks. But I think what's new is that you can do this all at once at the same time, being sort of omnipresent.
Mm-hmm. SimCity and its many offspring mm-hmm. are early versions of video games that engaged users in the work of urban planning.
Yes, exactly.
And that idea has evolved now into new forms of interaction between people and this idea of home or mm-hmm. cities. What's out there that's new in video games?
It's interesting to go and look at the history of SimCity and how it sort of branched off into new directions. One very popular one that's gaining steam is Second Life. I don't know if you're familiar with this game, but it's another parallel universe where people can go in and, you know, build their own cities, actually launch products, have an identity that could be based on him or herself, similar to SimCity. But what's interesting is that people are actually buying and selling virtual goods online in this community and also selling property to each other. It's totally online. Corporations are also experimenting in this space. You know, there was a consortium recently of companies ranging from American Express to Intel who went in and bought an island in this virtual world just to see how companies could interact in this space and what they could make of it as a training tool. But what's kind of fascinating is, you know, people who might not be able to afford real estate in real life are becoming, you know, mini real estate moguls with other people online in Second Life. And there are other ones, too, that haven't gotten a lot of press. One up-and-coming one is called Active Worlds, which is not a totally new company, but one that hasn't gotten a lot of buzz, which I think people will be paying attention to. They're building sort of the first and largest virtual mall online that people can come into from all over the world. And it'll be sort of interesting to see how the urban plans within Active World sort of build around this sort of commercial real estate development.
I heard a woman say the other night that her friend was getting married mm-hmm. in one of these parallel lives.
Wow.
And she was very concerned about her friend. I mean, she said, I think she's gone off the deep end.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that kind of behavior is that the natural next step, or is that dysfunctionality? What's going on there?
Well, I think we're starting to really redefine what we understand as space, you know, and identity and the world, you know, not to be sort of so broad in speaking. But, you know, we're really seeing people, you know, build identities and build lives and build physical cities and spaces online and in these games. And they're becoming very real. But I think also people have to keep in mind that sometimes the virtual actually increases the value of the physical. You know, I think some relationships that maybe began either online or within a game like Second Life, or there's another very popular fantasy game called World of Warcraft, where a lot of people meet online and have, you know, friends in these virtual spaces and even romantic relationships. It sort of increases the anticipation of the experience of the physical life, and I think that's an area that would be interesting to explore, you know, for psychologists and individuals alike.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you talk about heightening the anticipation. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think that's true from perhaps some of the shopping experiences.
Yes.
I'm not a gamer. I just, you know, I don't get it.
It's a great example, actually, that you just gave, you know, in terms of online shopping, which is such a phenomenon, you know. I mean, I know that some retail outlets like J.Crew recently, I think, did more sales online than they ever had in their catalog. And it's quite phenomenal, you know, that sort of idea that at any place, any time, you can sort of have, you know, these vast inventories open to you. And there is that sort of, you know, experience of receiving the present in the mail after you mm-hmm. order it online mm-hmm. that might not be sort of as exciting as sort of sifting through things on a limited inventory on the rack. So
mm-hmm.
Maybe that sense of possibility and then also the sort of lag time of waiting for the real, maybe that carries over into other areas as well.
Well, do you think that the online experience creates a higher or different expectation for the urban experience, the actual experience?
That could be very possible. But what's kind of interesting about, you know, the phenomenon of or phenomena of SimCity, Second Life, et cetera, is how people, I think, are learning to feel like they are really literally part of an urban area or part of a city, or they own part of it, which it's kind of amazing. I mean, I feel like it's very empowering. And then going back even to the sort of cell phone PDA, you know, being in your sort of own space within the larger urban areas, you're walking around, I think people are really getting strong senses of self and strong individual experiences of urban spaces, which is kind of fascinating. You know, I mean, they feel like they can really own a city like Manhattan, you know, either in a virtual world or then in the physical world when they're sort of seeming isolated with their, you know, all of their personal electronics. They're creating their own experience of Manhattan that's very unique to him or herself, you know, with a mm-hmm. unique soundtrack or a unique experience while walking the streets.
Mm-hmm. In your book, let's talk about your book, New Media Art. Mm-hmm. You describe a number of projects
yes.
that use new media to change the way people interact with and influence their environment. Umbrella.net and mm-hmm. Vectorial Elevation are two of those projects. Talk about those projects.
They're quite amazing. You know, they are conceived of as artworks, but they really address how people sort of connect in cities via technology. You know, Umbrella.net is a wonderful way of connecting to sort of ad hoc mobile networks. It involves people carrying these beautiful umbrellas and walking through the streets, and the umbrellas are equipped with devices that can pick up mobile networks. So you can physically see if you are connecting with another person and sort of jumping onto their mobile network. And it's a way of sort of making physical and poetic, you know, this idea that, okay, we might be walking alone in a city, we might not know the person next to us, but we actually might be on the same mobile network or the same Wi-Fi network. And it's just a nice way of understanding, you know, how we actually are connected, even though we're in these individual worlds because of our personal technology. And Vectorial Elevation is an amazing project. It's ongoing. It takes place in public squares around the world. Basically, users around the globe can sort of log on online and basically orchestrate this spectacular light show of giant spotlights that create these incredible lines in the sky, and anybody can sort of log on and create their own mass light show in a public square in Mexico, say. And again, it's sort of this idea that we're all connected. It's easy to feel lost in sort of a very vast urban space or public space, but new media sort of allows us to connect.
Have you ever seen Vectorial Elevation?
I haven't seen that live. I've seen other work by this artist, Rafael Lozano Hemmer, who is just an amazing technician and an incredibly gifted artist. He works public space and the space of the internet with an incredible level of virtuosity. I mean, he really understands how to bring these two things together, you know, what you were talking about, these sort of isolating elements of technology, and then sort of manifest them on a grand scale.
I love that idea. And as you describe Umbrella.net and what happened there, it reminds me of a lecture I heard from one of the artists you feature in your book, Natalie Jeremijenko, who is not only an artist but also trained in science and engineering. And she uses her work to illuminate social issues, particularly environmental issues. And in her lecture, she contrasted information that is publicly accessible versus publicly digestible. And of course, working as I do in the public realm and on public issues, that just hit home for me. She talked about, she would use the example of, for instance, EPA information on your community.
Yeah.
You can find it. It's accessible.
Yes.
But to interpret it is a different thing.
And
then
she, hard.
Yeah, very hard. And then she uses her work to make important information we need to know, digestible.
Yes. That's what's so interesting about a lot of the artists that we featured in this book, Natalie's work, also the two artworks that you mentioned. A lot of these artists that are working with technology, that's a theme that they address in their work, is how do you translate, you know, this information that's kept secret, or even if it's not kept secret, if it's presented as transparent, how do you translate information more simply and effectively? And that's what's so effective about a lot of these artworks. A lot of these artists are trained at taking complex information or complex ideas and turning them into sort of beautiful imagery to communicate information that otherwise might be, as you said, accessible but not digestible.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Rena Jana. She's a writer for Business Week, where she covers innovation and design, and she is also co-author with Mark Tribe of the new book, New Media Art. Is there a project? You feature these wonderful projects in your book. I love the descriptions and the graphics of them. Are there one or two that stand out for you that you were particularly compelled by?
They're all very, very compelling. There are a couple that I think are kind of particularly fascinating. One is an ongoing project called Carnivore, and this sort of speaks to the idea of accessible information in a different way. It's by a collective called RSG, or Radical Software Group. And the name of the project is based on software that's actually used by the FBI, that was nicknamed Carnivore, that actually, you know, can go through and sniff out data and see what people are transmitting in their own emails, et cetera, and what they're looking at online. And what this group RSG did was basically use similar software, but turn data into these really gorgeous projects that are very painterly. And it sounds very scary, but what this group was trying to do is just sort of communicate to people that, you know, issues on security, issues on personal information, how accessible data might be, even if you think you have a very secure network, sort of bringing out these really serious topics in a very sort of visually engaging way, and sort of subtly trying to make people, you know, private citizens aware of what might or might not be going on sort of behind closed doors and behind networks.
Mm-hmm. One of the observations you make in your book is that New Media Art was, from its inception, a worldwide movement. If you look to New Media Art for clues about the attributes other global endeavors or movements might have, what do you see, Rena?
It's interesting. It's one can really see that there's a lot of power in this, in the new media, even if it's very simple, and that a lot of political, environmental, social movements can come together in a way that maybe they haven't been able to in the past. And then the other thing that's very interesting about sort of this idea of a global movement is that change can happen very quickly online and across borders, that maybe was not able to happen so quickly in the past. You know, everything from raising awareness for sort of a political or environmental campaign to actually making a statement. You know, there's one project in the book, Electronic Disturbance Theater, which sort of is based on a denial of service attack. It's sort of a, you know, I don't want to say benign, but a way of sort of overloading, an organization's inbox and sort of crippling it to make a statement. It's sort of like a virtual sit-in that can be done rather quickly and maybe not so disruptively, but disruptively enough to raise sort of public awareness very quickly without many means. But at the same time, too, there are a lot of other movements that aren't covered in this book that are happening right now. For example, new media is allowing designers to experiment with imagery that's actually helping kids cope with cancer pain, you know, sort of looking at underwater imagery or proven soothing imagery that sort of distracts children from being afraid when they go into the hospital for treatment. So, you know, while that's not a political movement, it's sort of a movement towards, you know, new ways of moving forward with ideas very quickly with real world results.
Mm-hmm. Let's come back and talk a minute about Business Week. You've just introduced a special insert. You call it Inside Innovation. Why is Business Week focusing so much attention now on design and innovation?
A lot of it is what comes up over and over and over in our offices is sort of this idea of the iPod effect. You know, I think people are really aware of design now. Another company that comes up a lot in discussions is Target and how that company sort of turned around from a regional retailer to this sort of national and international sensation, all via a focus on design. Mm-hmm. So, and with the proliferation, going full circle back to the beginning of our discussion today, with the ubiquity of all of these personal electronics and the need for really simple interfaces, et cetera, design and this idea of innovation or sort of remaking things so that they're easier to use or more elegant to use, and also very forward-thinking, pushing the envelope into invention. Both of those things are really coming together in the business world, and people are really seeing that the sense of creativity is really important.
What do you think urban leaders can learn from new media, or how can they use it to make their cities more appealing?
Well, it seems like, you know, these ideas of the network can be used very metaphorically. And also, literally, I mean, it would be really fascinating to see how urban leaders might be able to experiment in the virtual space. You know, I mean, one could plan, say, a section of the city in a space like Second Life or maybe Active Worlds and really use these spaces to one's advantage, you know, before sort of carrying out a project. You know, it sort of goes or it's in line with an idea that's very hot right now in sort of the innovation practice world, which is that of rapid prototyping. Mm-hmm. You know, urban leaders could really use tools like or games as tools like Second Life to sort of rapid prototype maybe a new area of the city. Or real estate developers could maybe work with urban planners as well in a game like Second Life and rapid prototype a shopping center that might, you know, would it disrupt a certain community? You could sort of play around with that and even have residents from those communities weigh in and participate in this game on Second Life. And you could do a lot of sort of focus group testing and rapid prototyping, I think, using new media, which would be fascinating to see and at a relatively low cost, too.
Rena, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol. It's such a pleasure.
Rena Janna covers innovation and design for Business Week. Her book, written with Mark Tribe, is New Media Art. CityView's commentator Walker Smith joins us each week to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
I boarded a plane to Houston one morning for an important meeting. I had been cultivating a client for months over the phone. This was to be our first face-to-face meeting. I was so anxious that I sprinted outside after deplaning to grab a cab. The driver looked puzzled when I gave him the address. "I've never heard of that street," he said. I couldn't believe my bad fortune, stuck with yet another cabbie who didn't know his local area. But I bit my tongue and repeated the address. "It's an office building," I said. They told me it's near the airport. The cab driver asked me if I was sure of the address. This got me agitated, so he pulled out his city map and looked up the street name. It took him a minute, but finally he pointed and said, "Oh, here it is." When I saw where he was pointing, I barked, "That can't be it. That's a residential neighborhood, and this is a huge office building." The cab driver said he would ask the airport cab starter. I started muttering about quarrelsome cabbies as he got out and walked over to the cab stand. I was steaming mad when suddenly I thought about where I was. Houston. I thought back to my phone calls with the client, dialing area code 214, call after call, week after week. "That's Houston, right?" I asked myself. But now I wasn't sure. And even if I was wrong, I wasn't going to admit it to this cab driver. He came back and said, "The starter's never heard of that street either. Are you sure of the address?" Faking a frustrated fury, I stomped out of the cab, growling that I would find a driver who knew his way around. But I made a beeline for a phone booth and flipped open the phone book. I found the area code and read it aloud to myself. 713. Not 214, but 713. At that instant, I remembered that 214 is Dallas. And here I was in Houston. I looked at my watch and saw that it was now time for my meeting, but I was in the wrong city. The client was forgiving, but it took another 5 years to get a second chance. Since that day, I have been a lot more careful about securing and verifying details before I leave town. No matter how important the meeting, nothing will happen unless the details are secured. For me, this is just about business. But this imperative applies to even the grandest of our social and political initiatives. Whether it's disarming a rogue nation, or installing democracy, or bringing in disaster relief, big ideas and ideals are nothing unless the details are secured. So when we see our moral causes dashed upon the rocks of overlooked contingencies and logistics, it's time to demand better planning, diligence, and care, because otherwise we'll be forced to wait many more years before we get a chance to make it up. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelevich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.